In recent times, the subject of our missionary work in Thailand has come up as we've been talking with various folks here. And I thought the time had arrived when it would be a good idea if I went back and gave you some background concerning what Gay and I believe to be God's call to us to serve him as missionaries in Thailand. And in a very low-key fashion, you might say, talk about our early experiences as we prepared ourselves to go to Thailand, and then some of the things that we met when we arrived there and tried to get a church going. I trust that these things will not only be of some interest concerning ourselves personally, for those of you who've been asking about these matters, but also will be instructive for us as a church concerning our own church growth and outreach. So it's going to be largely biographical as I talk about Gay and myself and our own experiences. It's a testimony, I suppose, a recounting of our own experiences with the spin-off. I hope that we'll get something for ourselves as we go through. Let's take a reading from Romans chapter 10. I'm going to read from verse 13 to 17. I'll just skip out a couple of verses where there's a quote from the Old Testament worked in there so that we can maintain the drift of the writer's argument here in Romans chapter 10. Verse 13, "For everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. But how are men to call upon him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they've never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? And how can men preach unless they are sent?" And then there's the quotation down to verse 17. "And so faith comes from what is heard. What is heard comes through the preaching. And the preaching, of course, is the gospel of Jesus Christ." Well, let's go back to the beginning. I'm going back here, 30 odd years, back to the days when Gay and I were courting back in our late teens. We both come from a Christian background, church-going background, that sort of thing, where there'd been some sort of interest in missionary work. We'd both been exposed to missionary presentations, missionaries home on leave showing their pictures, and missionaries in and out of our houses, missionary magazines lying around, that sort of thing. So there was some sort of vague knowledge of what missionary work was about. Just for my own point here, this first little bit will have to be as I see it, and then I'll incorporate our two visions jointly as we get along a little bit further. I guess like a lot of people, we sort of drift along. You just come up through the ranks, you come through the church, you've had a fairly straight upbringing through the church, and just how much reality there is to a person's faith is very much a debatable question. But I can well remember when I was in this late teens stage of being very much convicted over my own relationship with God, my own spirituality, and how serious I really was about the Christian life. So I set aside for myself some time every day for some serious Bible reading, and it was as I started to read that I started to get jolted by a few things. I can remember one of the early verses that struck me, and incidentally I'm going to quote quite a lot of miscellaneous verses as we go on this next little part, was Paul writing to the Corinthians when he said, "He who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. But he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully." And I was very well aware that my own life was not a very rich life spiritually. I was sowing very sparingly indeed, and I wasn't getting much spiritual harvest as a result. I can recall also, I was teaching Sunday school at the time and going through one of the gospel stories where Jesus talks to people about being disciples. Matthew and Mark, you know the references, "If any man is going to come after me, let him take up his cross and follow me." And then he talked about making various sacrifices for my sake and the gospel's. For my sake and the gospel's. That was coming through time and time again. And again, it was obvious to me that I was living largely for my own sake and my own ambitions and my own enjoyment. Not very much for God's sake and the gospel's at all. Coming to the end of Matthew, those well-known verses struck home to me one day. The very last verses of Matthew's Gospel where Jesus said, "Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations." And I think for the first time, the responsibility that we have started to dawn on me. You've got to go and make disciples of all nations. Go into all the world, baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teach them all the things that I taught you. And remember, he says, "I'll be with you always, even to the close of the age." Well, then I started reading through the whole New Testament, several chapters a day. And just as I went through book after book, various things occurred to me. For example, going through the book of Acts, I can remember reading about Paul and Barnabas in their missionary travels. They were men who hazarded their lives for the sake of the gospel. They risked their lives for the sake of the gospel. It's interesting, the impressionable things that happened to you in your youth. With a few other young chaps, I went out to the Carnarvons. That was in the days when the Carnarvons were not opened up to the public as they are today, and we had what we thought was a fairly heroic time out there investigating all sorts of things and running what we considered to be great risks as we enjoyed ourselves adventurously. It was passing through my mind then, here I am out here, tramping through the jungle and scaling cliffs and trying to do he-managed things for my own enjoyment. I had only recently been hearing about missionaries in New Guinea and some of the hacking through the jungle and hiking long distances they had to do as they went from village to village. And again, it was just being driven home to me that life was largely being lived for one's own enjoyment. One could equally undergo various hardships and hazards for the sake of the gospel instead of for the sake of oneself. And then into Romans, which is the next book. And there we read of what Paul said, "I have made it my ambition to preach the gospel in places where Christ has not yet been heard of. I don't want to build on another man's foundation." And again, the conviction was coming there that here we are drifting along, following everybody else and cashing in on all the benefits of church and what other people do for us. How about thinking of taking the gospel to places where Christ has not been heard of and starting from scratch? The pennies were starting to drop and the conviction was growing. Then across into the next book, which was Corinthians, and in Corinthians again I read what Paul said. "I want to preach the gospel in the regions beyond you." Now he was talking to the people in Corinth, and what he was saying was he wanted to move off into further regions to the west, getting into Italy and ultimately into Spain. But the point was he wanted to move on out of that established environment into the unreached areas, into the regions beyond. I don't want to boast about work already done in another man's field. So the same idea as we have in Romans. Next book is Galatians. The very first chapter of Galatians, Paul talks of how God had called him. He says, "God chose me even before I was born to serve him, so that I might preach the gospel among the heathen." And these references to the regions beyond, to the heathen, to those who'd never heard, were constantly cropping up. Now this was going on over quite a few months. One night there was a youth meeting at the Wynnum Church where Gay and I were going on Saturday nights. The speaker was a missionary, and he took as his section on which he preached that section that I've just read from Romans 10. And the words that really drove themselves home were, "How shall I hear without a preacher?" And it was at that point then that I first mentioned the subject to Gay as we were walking home, and I found that she had been going through something of the same sort of spiritual pilgrimage. Maybe sometime if she wants to recount her personal experiences, well, fair enough. But as we talked about those things together, it was obvious to us that we had similar impressions, similar thoughts, and I believe that God was directing us both independently along the same channel. But from this point on, of course, it now becomes something that was the very air we breathed and something we talked about constantly and prayed about. But as I say, we were still impressionable teenagers, getting older and wiser, one would hope, as we moved along. Nevertheless, believing that God was planning something for us ahead. Well, then, of course, you start to think about all the difficulties. You mention this to one or two people, and then people say, "But you do know what it's all about. I mean, after all, you're not even 20 yet. You are just youngsters, and the hardships of missionary life are very great, and you have great disappointments, and things fall apart at the seams, and nothing goes right. Do you realize what you're letting yourself in for?" I suppose it's true to say that we did have rather impressionistic view of things, which is understandable enough. But we had no intention of screaming off anywhere. It was going to be a long process, as you'll find as we move the story on. But as these doubts came into our minds, the Lord reassured us with various verses as we continued to read the scriptures. One of them was, of course, the well-known quote from Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Now, as I've grown to know the book of Philippians a bit better, I find that our original understanding of that verse was probably taken a bit out of context, but it conveyed a truth which, at that stage, I think was very important for us to grasp, that no matter what the difficulty may be, come rain, hail or snow, we can still do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And there's a similar mention of this prevailing power of Christ in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul concludes the chapter by saying, "Therefore, my beloved, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord," and here are the words, "knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." And the emphasis once again is through the Lord, through Christ we can do these things. In Christ our labor will not be in vain. And a similar thing is said in Galatians chapter 2, where Paul says, "Yet not I, but Christ. In the life I now live, I live through faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me." But the emphasis there again, "Yet not I, but Christ. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Our labor is not in vain if it is in the Lord. Also, I can recall a person giving a talk at another one of these youth meetings on Jonah and how Jonah ran away from the task. God had a task for Jonah to do, to go and preach to certain people that he didn't want to preach to because they were heathen and they weren't likely to respond. And anyway, he was a Jew. He thought religion was for the Jews. He wanted to keep God for himself. And he ran away and came across some very unexpected adventures. But the warning was there. Well, all this time we were both studying. I was doing an architecture course and Gay was doing a course in radiography. I felt, through a variety of circumstances, that I should drop the course and concentrate on developing my biblical knowledge and getting more experience in Christian things. I'm not sure that I would give the same advice to somebody else. As I say, we're impressionable. Youth is very impressionable. We tend to see life as laid out before us, and these days of the late teens and early 20s, where we're thinking about some of the major decisions of life and wondering just where it's all going to go, and of course 5 years looks like an eternity from that perspective. The longer you get on, of course, the longer you realize that 5 years is really nothing, and it's gone before you know where you are. If a person was doing a course in some sort of study, any field of study, and felt that God was in some way directing them towards the mission field, I would not advise that person to drop the course. I'd say go ahead and finish it, because any study and qualification that you get under the belt is going to be of assistance to you later on. The few extra years spent in achieving a degree of expertise or qualification is going to be more than compensated for by the added benefit you're going to be in whatever place you go. Nevertheless, at that stage, I felt that these heathen were dropping into hell at a tremendous rate, and I had to do something about stemming the tide, and so I stopped my course and got involved in a number of things in the church and sought to do a bit of Bible study. Now, some of the things that spoke to me at that stage were, again, these very, very lively verses, ones that set you back in your heels a little bit when you read them. For example, in Hebrews chapter 12, talking, or was it chapter 11, talking about Moses and the great men of faith, and it says, "Moses, when he grew up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and he chose rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin." Now, I'm not suggesting that if you're an architect, then you're enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. But as I saw it, the whole of my study was directed towards establishing good practice and being a bit of a name, getting myself a nice house to live in, and generally getting along in this world, getting a bit of status and doing the things that architects are supposed to do for themselves. This came as something of a challenge as I considered what Moses did and what he forsook, the palace of Egypt and all the pleasures and everything that went with it, and he suffered affliction with God's people. And then the next book, we're still going through the New Testament, you see, this wheeling on book after book after book. James, the next book. "The friendship with the world," he says, "makes you an enemy of God. You've got to work out your values, where your interests lie. What comes first, God or your own selfish ambition?" Move on a couple of books later to John. 1 John, the well-known verses in John where he talks about the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. All these things, he said, they're not of the Father, they are of the world. And in my state of mind, those things were pricking my conscience rather vividly. Philippians, once again, where Paul said, "The things that were gain to me, those I considered to be loss for Christ." There's no doubt that a lot of our lives are lived very selfishly, and we don't seem to take into consideration what God might have us to do. We will make sacrifices for our own advancement, for our own ambition. We are not inclined normally to make sacrifices for God. We will carry on our pursuits, our pleasures, our pastimes, our occupation, our studies, and that always seems to come first with us. And if God's interests interfere, well, God's interests, unfortunately, normally suffer. Now, it ought to be the other way around. It ought to be our own interests that suffer Remember, it's always for my sake in the Gospels, says Jesus, that we are following him. Well, about this time I went into the army for national service training. And that was a great experience. It really was something that I wanted to do, not that I wanted to go into the army, but now that I had this inkling in the back of my mind of serving God and missionary work, I wanted to go through a few toughening up courses, and the army was one of them. Now, one didn't have a lot of choice in this matter because conscription meant that you went in whether you liked it or not. But it was a great experience, and it certainly steeled my Christian faith enormously. From a spiritual point of view, it was one of the best periods that I had in helping this development and strengthening of one's commitment to Jesus Christ. I also started an evening Bible study course, and Gay likewise. The two of us, we went along there and we went through the evening Bible school seeking to equip ourselves a bit better. We were still working during the day. We were still both doing studies of different sorts in our spare time and making it our business to really become more intelligent in relation to the Bible. That was a starting point. We also started to write letters. Now, we had by this time confided in the elders, the leaders of our respective churches. I was from Cannon Hill, Gay was from Wynnum. But we'd got them together and we'd talked about these things. We'd got them interested in what we were doing and we found that they were very supportive. They were quite pleased. They had a few words of wisdom to offer, but they didn't dampen our enthusiasm and say, oh, you're too young, it's going to be terribly difficult. Rather, they encouraged us to have a feet on the ground approach, to get involved in the church, to get some experience under our belt, to keep on studying, to doing the things we were doing. But also they said, start educating yourself as best you can about the mission fields of the world. And so we did. We started to write to missionaries. And bit by bit, we added one country to another. Various countries of the Pacific, like Papua New Guinea, places in Asia, like Malaysia and Thailand, India, Africa, a couple of countries in Africa, in South America. And so we spread our interests around the world and established correspondence with missionaries in various places. Also started to read books, get hold of National Geographics and things out of the library and anything that was going to educate us concerning what the world was about, make ourselves more familiar with the needs of different places. Our reading of missionary magazines increased, and in general things started to turn around rapidly as our interest in all sorts of people and areas grew. I also did a course in bookkeeping. I felt here again, if eventually we're going to be missionaries and we're going to be in some place self-supporting, more or less, certainly not in a wages and salary situation, then we needed to have sensible control of our financial matters. So I went along and did a course in bookkeeping and related subjects, elementary accountancy and so on. Also learned how to type, all these things that are going to be of use later on. And then in due course, I went down to Sydney for a couple of years to a full-time Bible college. Gay, meanwhile, was in Brisbane, still working and still being involved in various activities in the church. We were both very much involved in Sunday school youth work. And by this time, of course, I was starting to preach around the place. Started off just with a small talk for children, opening the evening service, giving a short 5-minute talk. Then later on, getting to the stage where one was able to take the full service and so develop some sort of preaching ministry. Very elementary. However, I was very much aware of the fact that just preaching around the place was not the be-all and end-all of things. Also, I imagine the preaching was rather second-rate, the main difficulty not being that one was simply nervous, but that the content was not sufficient, it was not solid enough. I simply did not have as good a grasp of the Bible as I ought to have. So then I went down to Sydney and did a couple of years' course in Bible college, which was of considerable benefit. And as I say, Gay kept on working up here, and then at the end of that time, we were married, settled down here in Balmoral. Well, we kept on going, and we got involved in the church. We attached ourselves to the Cannon Hill Church there. In fact, we got more than just attached to it. It was a case of getting involved, because there weren't very many people there, and the whole activity of the church was something that more and more involved our time and effort. We got more involved in other aspects of Christian activity, studies at a number of camps, ministry and teaching and preaching over a wider area, lecturing in the evening Bible school. And then, of course, there was the beginnings of a family as our first one, Karen, was born. After we'd been married a couple of years, Karen arrived on the scene. And then later on, of course, Bruce. Now, we had planned this time in Australia, more or less. We had no intention of getting married and then screaming off to the mission field somewhere. We felt that it was most essential that after we were married, that we settled down for a few years, partly to get a family started, but also to get that experience in the church and also that general solidity in married life and in the beginnings of family life. Also a bit of financial backing. I don't think it's a wise move to go off into the regions beyond without having some sort of financial support. Now, our source of income there was going to be rather uncertain, but at least we could do our bit by making sure that over those 4 years we worked and saved and at least could make sure we got ourselves there and had a bit of a cushion to protect us, particularly through those early months when there are a lot of outlays, a lot of expenditure has to be made, as you all know, setting up house in some other place, let alone overseas. All of these things are in the back of our mind, and so for the next 4 years we got involved in the whole range of Christian activity, equipped ourselves better and better, we hoped, for the work that lay ahead of us. I should think that the main section of the New Testament that was driving us on here was what Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4. He said, "Let no one despise your youth." Well, now we're a little bit older than we were a few years previously, of course, but I suppose there was still that element of youth and inexperience there. But I think we were learning. He said, "Set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity. Until I come," Paul intended to go and visit Timothy, but in the meantime, he says, "give your full attention to the public reading of the scriptures, to preaching, and to teaching. Do not neglect the gift that you have, which was given you by prophetic utterance when the elders laid their hands upon you. Practice these duties. Devote yourself to them, so that all may see your progress. Take heed to yourself and to your teaching. Hold to that, for by so doing you will save both yourself and your hearers." Now I think you can see the essence of that little section. Devote yourself to these activities. Develop your gift. Practice these things. Preaching, teaching, ministry in the church, whatever way it is, if God has given you a gift, work hard at developing it so that it might be useful for him over a wider area in the years ahead. And so that's largely what those 4 years were about. However, during those 4 years, I'd also been doing other studies. In fact, I studied all those 4 years external courses through the Melbourne College of Divinity, formal theological studies, which were of enormous benefit because now I was completely on my own. And I pretty soon found that what I'd got up to resident Bible college was nothing more than merely an introduction. You pretty soon cast off those notes. They're like your grade 1, grade 2 material at school, because when you get into grade 5, grade 6, grade 7, you no longer need your grade 1, grade 2 material. But if you didn't go through your grade 1 and grade 2, you would never have got to these others. And I think it was largely those studies that I did, those external studies over those 4 years, which really got me on my own feet, got me studying the Bible sensibly, I hope, for myself, and developing what I should consider to be a more mature outlook on life, and particularly on this whole subject of God's guidance. Because now, it appeared to us, and Gay and I had been moving along the same track, because we share everything, and we were completely at ease with each other, and all things were discussed between us, and so we were moving along the same track together all the time. And it had struck us very forcibly that God was no longer dealing with us the way he was dealing with us, say, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10 years earlier. I don't think that now I would get God's guidance and direction the way I outlined at the beginning of this talk, going through all those impressionistic verses, all those striking verses. But God can only deal with us according to the stage we are at. That's the marvellous thing about God's grace. God never waits until we've reached perfection of understanding before he tells us anything. Otherwise, he'd wait forever, because we've never reached it. Here we are, further along the track, 30-odd years from where I began, and still just moving ahead, still greatly lacking in knowledge and understanding, but hopefully moving ahead. That's the main thing. We are moving ahead. And so whatever stage of our development we are at, we're still a long way short of perfection, but we are, I hope, moving ahead. And what God does is, if I can put it this way, he adjusts his communication to the level we're at. Now let me come back to my illustration about school. Supposing you're explaining to a child, 3, 4, or 5, about how it rains, and you've got a very simple explanation about, let's say, evaporation, if you can get that one across, but then you've got these clouds up in the sky, and the water fills them, they get heavier and heavier and heavier, until eventually it's so heavy that the water drops down, and we call that rain. That's one way of explaining it. Now, when you get along into school and you get up to the stage of, say, grade 5 or 6 or 9, whatever it is, and you're studying things at a higher level, of course you have a better understanding of how it rains. If later on you make as your field of study in life a meteorology or something to do with the weather, well, of course you learn all about these complicated matters that go on in relation to the atmospheric pressures and so forth and so on. Now, in each stage of that development, I would hope that what we've got is a reasonably true picture of things. But in some cases, it's very, very simple. In some cases, it's not quite so simple. In other cases, it's far more complicated. If I'm talking to a person, and if I am a person who's skilled in meteorology, well, then I can talk to another meteorologist in language each understand. But if, of course, a person is not so skilled, well, I adjust my communication so that person can understand. And if I'm talking only to a 3 or 4 year old, I can adjust my communication so that that child can understand. We've got to speak to people at the level that they can understand. And that's what God does with us. And if that's the only way we can understand, well, God treats us in that way. And I'm quite sure that even though I may not get my guidance today by having all these isolated verses plucked out of their context and thrown at me, at that stage, going back to our late teens, that was the stage we were at. That was the only degree of Christian discernment we had. But God spoke to us accordingly. All of us, as we mature in life, we find that less and less do we rely upon the spectacular. These people that have all these miracles, you know, some people are always talking about visions they had and miracles they saw and goodness knows what not. I believe all of those things are a sign of immaturity. I think there's plenty in the New Testament to back up that statement. I'm not going to develop that line now, but those more spectacular gifts or the more spectacular happenings are for people whose faculties are so underdeveloped that they need that sort of thing to impress them. But when we become better developed, when we mature and grow as Christians, God treats us as mature, growing, intelligent people. It's far less spectacular. We're far less impressionable. But God is dealing with us according to the degree that we have learnt to think Christianly, to think more as a mature Christian ought to think, and God guides us accordingly. So the decisions that we have to make, and making a decision about where you're going to go and serve God, leave behind your homeland and go overseas for quite a number of years, it really is a major decision, and you wonder how you're going to arrive at it. Well, by this time, we were no longer looking for the magic verses to fall out of the sky. We weren't looking for the word Thailand or New Guinea to appear out of some verse in the Bible, because it simply isn't there. Nor were we looking for some little 3 or 4 word phrase somewhere that could leap in golden letters out of the text of the page and brand itself upon our hearts in such a way that we had to pick up our goods and chattels and go marching out the door the next day. There was nothing spectacular or momentous like that. But over these first 4 years of our married life, we had very sensibly, I should trust, or seriously would be a better word, considered this whole matter of what God is doing with us and how he directs us. And I suppose I could summarize our general attitude under 3 or 4 simple verses. Probably the basic one is the one in Proverbs where it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not rely on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your paths." I'm not sure even that that is necessarily speaking about God is going to show you the way to go. I think what it's rather saying is that whichever way you do go, it'll be God who's directing you in this way. But the important point that I want to get across here is that you trust in the Lord and you do not rely on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. That is the basic consideration. We must put God first. And if in all our ways we are acknowledging him, if we are putting God first, if we are not living just for ourselves and our own ambition, and our lives are directed towards God and his kingdom and his church and its interests, in our attitudes and behavior and relationships, we're putting God first, we can have the confidence that God is going to lead us in the way that's right. And in the end, the decision we make will be the right one, and we will have sufficient insight to know what is right. That word insight probably is one of the key considerations in this discussion. Our thinking is changed. In Romans chapter 12, Paul says to people concerning their understanding of God's will, "Do not be conformed to this world," that is, don't think the way ordinary people think, "but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." Renewal of your mind, and then you will know what the will of God is, what is good and acceptable and perfect. How do we know the will of God? By the renewing of our mind. We think Christianly. How is our mind renewed? It's renewed as we are saturated with the Bible and our whole value systems change. Our thinking changes, our perspectives change, And it's a constant process. It's going on degree by degree, stage by stage. Our mind is being renewed into a Christian mind. And as our mind is changed, so we are able to understand better what God's will is for us. In Philippians, Paul says, "Grow in love with knowledge and discernment so that you may choose what is right." With knowledge and discernment. In Colossians he says, "Be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and understanding." You see the emphases: wisdom, understanding, knowledge, discernment, mind. The development of Christian character, the development of the Christian mind, is going to lead a person to make all his decisions in life on a right basis. By this time we got to the stage where we realized that making a decision concerning where we were going to go and serve God was basically no different from making a decision on what street we'd live in, or what car we might buy, or what particular work one might have. The basics on which you make the decision are always the same. So whether it's a small decision or a major decision, you are looking at issues and considering the thing Christianly. Now obviously when you're buying a lawnmower, the considerations are not nearly so great as when you're buying a house. And when you're buying a house, the considerations are not nearly so great as when you're deciding who you're going to marry. All of these are decisions we have to make. But we must not be saying, oh, the minor decisions, I'll just make them off my own bat. And when we come to the important decisions, I'll go shopping around in the Bible to find a magic verse to tell me where to go. That is a very immature way of doing it. We should be developing a Christian perspective on life, a Christian estimate of values, a Christian thought, a Christian mind, so that the whole of our thinking and all the decisions, from the little ones to the big ones, are being made on the same basis, that our mind is saturated with God's word. We are learning to view life Christianly and make decisions as mature, growing people. Not being forced around by circumstances, not sitting back passively waiting for something to manipulate us through the door, but actually in faith making decisions and acting upon them. So the first thing, I would just summarize that under the point of thinking. Our thinking is changed. So we did a lot of thinking. The second point, a lot of talking to other people, because other people have wisdom besides us. In Proverbs it says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who listens to advice is wise." We had a very small circle of people that we talked to. We didn't talk to a great range of people. Lots of people knew, of course, of our interest in missionary work, but there was a small group of people that we took into our confidence, with whom we spoke more specifically, and they were of tremendous help. So there's not only thinking, there's also talking. And then also there is praying. Because when it's all boiled down, we feel totally inadequate to make the right decision. We feel we lack the wisdom, and we don't quite know what to do. Well, James gives us this promise: if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, without doubting. For he who doubts is like the wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Well, we did feel it was a tremendous decision. We weren't quite sure what to do, how to make the decision. We were moving, we hoped, in the right direction. We were devoting ourselves to the gifts God had given us, trying to develop them, practice these things. All those verses I've read, we were trying to put them into practice. But sooner or later, you've got to make a hard, cold decision. Now, as we move towards that point, by this time, Bruce had been born, and we were moving more and more towards the stage where we felt we could think seriously now about preparing for overseas. And I think when eventually we left, Bruce was about 10 months of age. By this time, of course, we ourselves, I should think, are about 9 years on from when we first believed God spoke to us through those words, "How shall they hear without a preacher?" I guess we were 17 going on 18 or something of that nature. When we went overseas, we were 26. So there was a long time, but over those years, God was doing his work. There's nothing to rush into. This is part of the way we see things looking back. At the time, it looks an enormous time ahead. 3 years looks like an eternity. We look back from this perspective and see that those, whatever it was, 8 or 9 years that we spent in equipping ourselves were invaluable. In fact, I'm quite sure that had it not been that we'd had those years and waited till we got a bit of experience and maturity under our belts, if it hadn't been for that, then I'm sure that our missionary work would have fouled up very quickly. God is not in the hurry that we are in. We don't want to leave things too late, of course. There does come a time when it's really too late. But then again, we don't want to go rushing into things. No one can legislate for anybody else, and our experience may not be the same as other people's experiences. But there it is. That's the way it was with us. Well, as we considered all the issues, we considered the stage of development of our family, we considered our own involvement in Christian work. I might add that we'd had a number of other offers. As the years had gone on, since we were married, I had a couple of offers for other types of service, some of them in Australia, which were very attractive, very appealing, Bible college lecturing and things of that nature, which looked a little less risky than, say, going to a place like Thailand. But as we considered all the possibilities, we got away one weekend and we just sat down and we talked about things. Just the two of us went through from start to finish and traced what was happening, and we just looked at each other and said, well, we ought to go. How about we go to Thailand? We said yes. So we both agreed that that was it. I'm not going to go into all the details as to why Thailand rather than anywhere else. We had been interested in lots of countries and we'd equipped ourselves with the knowledge of all these different places, and we got to know various personnel in different parts and the needs and requirements of different countries. And consistently over a period of quite a few years, our thoughts have been channeled more and more and more into the work, in particular Bangkok, and something that we could do there. And I'm going to talk about that next Sunday, pick up from here and see what happened when we actually got to Bangkok. Well, that's it. Now, I'm sure there's going to be a few questions that you want to ask and all that. If that's the case, well, you're perfectly free to ask them, as long as you don't steal too much of my ammunition for next week.